Chapter 8. Not feeling any enthusiasm myself about Athens, my bounden duty of course is clear, to sneer and laugh heartily at all who have. In fact, what business has a lawyer, who was in Pump Court this day 3 weeks, and whose common reading is law reports or the newspaper, to pretend to fall in love for the long vacation with mere poetry, of which I swear a great deal is very doubtful, and to get up an enthusiasm quite foreign to his nature and usual calling in life? What call have ladies to consider Greece a mantic, they who get their notions of mythology from the well-known pages of Tooke's Pantheon? What is the reason that blundering Yorkshire squires, young dandies from Corfu regiments, jolly sailors from ships in the harbor, and yellow old Indians returning from Bundelkhand, should think proper to be enthusiastic about a country of which they know nothing, the mere physical beauty of which they cannot, for the most part, comprehend? And because certain characters lived in it 2,400 years ago? What of these people in common with Pericles? What of these ladies in common with Aspasia Ophi, of the race of Englishmen who come wandering about the tomb of Socrates? Do you think the majority would not have voted to hemlock him? Yes. For the very same superstition which leads men by the nose now, drove them onward in the days when the lowly husband of Xanthippe died for daring to think simply and to speak the truth. I know of no quality more magnificent in fools than their faith. That perfect consciousness they have, that they are doing virtuous and meritorious actions, when they are performing acts of folly, murdering Socrates, or pelting Aristides with holy oyster shells all for virtue's sake, and a history of dullness in all ages of the world, is a book which a philosopher would surely be hanged, but as certainly blessed for writing. If Papa and Mama, honor be to them, had not followed the faith of their fathers, and thought proper to send away their only beloved son afterwards, to be celebrated under the name of Titmarsh, into 10 years' banishment of infernal misery, tyranny, annoyance, to give over the fresh feelings of the heart of the little Michelangelo to the discipline of vulgar bullies, who, in order to lead tender young children to the temple of learning as they do in the spelling books, drive them on with clenched fists and low abuse, if they fainted, revive them with a thump, or assailed them with a curse, if they were miserable, consoled them with a brutal jeer, if, I say, my dear parents, instead of giving me the inestimable benefit of a 10 years' classical education, had kept me at home with my dear 13 sisters, it is probable I should have liked this country of Attica, in sight of the blue shores, of which the present pathetic letter is written. But I was made so miserable in youth by a classical education, that all connected with it is disagreeable in my eyes. And I have the same recollection of Greek in youth that I have of castor oil. So in coming in sight of the promontory of Sunium, where the Greek muse, in an awful vision, came to me, and said in a patronizing way, "Why, my dear," she always, the old spinster, adopts this high and mighty tone, "Hi, my dear, are you not charmed to be in this famous neighborhood, in this land of poets and heroes, of whose history your classical education ought to have made you a master? If it did not, you have woefully neglected your opportunities, and your dear parents have wasted their money in sending you to school." I replied, "Madam, your company in youth was made so laboriously disagreeable to me, that I can't at present reconcile myself to you in age. I read your poets, but it was in fear and trembling, and a cold sweat is but an ill accompaniment to poetry. I blundered through your histories, but history is so dull, saving your presence of herself, that when the brutal dullness of a schoolmaster is superadded to her own slow conversation, the union becomes intolerable. Hence I have not the slightest pleasure in renewing my acquaintance with a lady who has been the source of so much bodily and mental discomfort to me. To make a long story short, I am anxious to apologize for a want of enthusiasm in the classical line, and to excuse an ignorance which is of the most undeniable sort. This is an improper frame of mind for a person visiting the land of Aeschylus and Euripides, Add to which, we have been abominably overcharged at the inn. And what are the blue hills of Attica, the silver calm basin of Piraeus, the heathery heights of Pentelicus, and yonder rocks crowned by the Doric columns of the Parthenon, and the thin Ionic shafts of the Erechtheum, to a man who has had little rest, and is bitten all over by bugs? Was Alcibiades bitten by bugs, I wonder, and did the brutes crawl over him as he lay in the rosy arms of Phryne? I wished all night for Socrates' hammock or basket, as it is described in the Lauds, in which resting place, no doubt, the abominable animals kept perforce clear of him. A French man of war, lying in the silvery little harbor, sternly eyeing out of its stern portholes a saucy little English corvette beside, began playing sounding marches as a crowd of boats came paddling up to the steamer's side to convey us travelers to shore. There were Russian schooners and Greek brigs lying in this little bay, dumpy little windmills whirling round on the sunburnt heights round about it. An improvised town of quays and marine taverns has sprung upon the shore, a host of jingling barriches, more miserable than any to be seen even in Germany, were collected at the landing place, and the Greek drivers, how queer they looked in skull caps, shabby jackets with profuse embroidery of worsted, and endless petticoats of dirty calico, began, in a generous ardor for securing passengers, to abuse each other's horses and carriages in the regular London fashion. Satire could certainly hardly caricature the vehicle in which we were made to journey to Athens, and it was only by thinking that, bad as they were, these coaches were much more comfortable contrivances than any Alcibiades or Cimon ever had, that we consoled ourselves along the road. It was flat for 6 miles along the plain to the city. And you see for the greater part of the way the purple mount on which the Acropolis rises, and the gleaming houses of the town spread beneath. Round this wide, yellow, barren plain, a stunted district of olive trees is almost the only vegetation visible there rises, as it were, a sort of chorus of the most beautiful mountains, the most elegant, gracious, and noble I ever looked on. These hills did not appear at all lofty or terrible, but superbly rich and aristocratic. The clouds were dancing round about them. You could see their rosy purple shadows sweeping round the clear serene summits of the hill. To call a hill aristocratic seems affected or absurd. But the difference between these hills and the others is the difference between Newgate Prison and the Travelers Club, for instance. Both are buildings, but the one stern, dark, and coarse, the other rich, elegant, and festive. At least, so I thought. With such a stately palace as munificent nature had built for these people, what could they be themselves but lordly, beautiful, brilliant, brave, and wise? We saw four Greeks on donkeys on the road, which is a dust whirlwind, where it is not a puddle, and other four were playing with a dirty pack of cards, at a barrack that English poets have christened the Elfway House. Does external nature and beauty influence the soul too good? You go about Warwickshire, and fancy that from merely being born, and wandering in those sweet sunny plains, and fresh woodlands, Shakespeare must have drunk in a portion of that frank artless sense of beauty which lies about his works like a bloom or dew. But a Coventry ribbon maker, or a slang Leamington squire, are looking on those very same landscapes too, and what do they profit? You theorize about the influence which the climate and appearance of Attica must have had in ennobling those who were born there. Yonder dirty, swindling, ragged blackguards, lolling over greasy carts 3 hours before noon, quarreling, and shrieking, armed to the teeth and afraid to fight, are bred out of the same land which begot the philosophers and heroes. But the Elfway House is passed by this time, and behold, we are in the capital of King Otho. I swear solemnly that I would rather have 200 a year in Fleet Street than be King of the Greeks, with Basilis written before my name round their beggarly coin, with the bother of perpetual revolutions in my huge plaster of Paris palace, with no amusement but a drive in the afternoon over a wretched arid country, where roads are not made, With ambassadors, the deuce knows why, for what good can the English, or the French, or the Russian party get out of such a bankrupt alliance as this?
Perpetually pulling and tugging at me, away from honest Germany, where there is beer and aesthetic conversation, and operas at a small cost. The shabbiness of this place actually beats Ireland, and that is a strong word. The Palace of the Basilisk is an enormous edifice of plaster, in a square containing 6 houses, 3 donkeys, no roads, no fountains, except in the picture of the inn. Backwards it seems to look straight to the mountain. On one side is a beggarly garden the king goes out to drive, revolutions permitting. At 5 some 24 blackguards saunter up to the huge sandhill of a terrace, as his majesty passes by in a gilt barouche and an absurd fancy dress. The gilt barouche goes plunging down the sandhills. The 24 soldiers, who have been presenting arms, slouch off to their quarters. The vast barrack of a palace remains entirely white, ghastly, and lonely, and, save the braying of a donkey now and then,
which long-eared minstrels are more active and sonorous in Athens than in any place I know,
all is entirely silent round Basilisk's palace. How could people who knew Leopold fancy he would be so olive green as to take such a berth? It was only a gobimich of a Bavarian that could ever have been induced to accept it.
I beseech you to believe that it was not the bill and the bugs at the inn which induced the writer hereof to speak so slightingly of the residence of Basilisk. These evils are now cured and forgotten. This is written off the leaden flats and mounds which they call the Trode. It is stern justice alone which pronounces this excruciating sentence. It was a farce to make this place into a kingly capital, and I make no manner of doubt that King Otho, the very day he can get away unperceived and get together the passage money, will be off for dear old Deutschland, Fatherland, Beerland. I have never seen a town in England which may be compared to this. For though Herne Bay is a ruin now, money was once spent upon it and houses built. Here, beyond a few score of mansions comfortably laid out, the town is little better than a rickety agglomeration of larger and smaller huts, tricked out here and there with the most absurd cracked ornaments and cheap attempts at elegance. But neatness is the elegance of poverty, and these people despise such a homely ornament. I have got a map with squares, fountains, theaters, public gardens, and places dotted marked out, but they only exist in the paper capital the wretched tumble-down wooden one boasts of none. One is obliged to come back to the old disagreeable comparison of Ireland. Athens may be about as wealthy a place as Carlo or Killarney. The streets swarm with idle crowds, the innumerable little lanes flow over with dirty little children. They are playing and puddling about in the dirt everywhere, with great big eyes, yellow faces, and the queerest little gowns and skull caps. But in the outer man, the Greek has far the advantage of the Irishman. Most of them are well and decently dressed. If 25 yards of petticoat may not be called decent, what may?
Comma, they swagger to and fro with huge knives in their girdles. Almost all the men are handsome, but live hard, it is said, in order to decorate their backs with those fine clothes of theirs. I have seen but 2 or 3 handsome women, and these had the great drawback which is common to the race, I mean, a sallow, greasy, coarse complexion, at which it was not advisable to look too closely. And on this score I think we English may pride ourselves on possessing an advantage.
By we, I mean the lovely ladies to whom this is addressed with the most respectful compliments,
over the most classical country in the world. I don't care for beauty which will only bear to be looked at from a distance, like a scene in a theater. What is the most beautiful nose in the world, if it be covered with a skin of the texture and color of coarse whitey brown paper, and if nature has made it as slippery and shining as though it had been anointed with pomatum? They may talk about beauty, but would you wear a flower that had been dipped in a grease pot? No, give me a fresh, dewy, healthy rose out of Somersetshire, not one of those superb, tawdry, unwholesome exotics, which are only good to make poems about. Lord Byron wrote more cant of this sort than any poet I know of. Think of the peasant girls with dark blue eyes of the Rhine, the brown-faced, flat-nosed, thick-lipped, dirty wenches. Think of illing I a cup of Samian wine, small beer as nectar compared to it, and Byron himself always drank gin. That man never wrote from his heart. He got up rapture and enthusiasm with an eye to the public. But this is dangerous ground, even more dangerous than to look Athens full in the face, and say that your eyes are not dazzled by its beauty. The great public admires Greece and Byron. The public knows best. Murray's Ouid book calls the latter her native bard. Our native bard. Mon Dieu. He's Shakespeare's, Milton's, Keats, Scott's native bard. Well, woe be to the man who denies the public gods. The truth is, then, that Athens is a disappointment, and I am angry that it should be so. To a skilled antiquarian, or an enthusiastic Greek scholar, the feelings created by a sight of the place of course will be different. But you who would be inspired by it must undergo a long preparation of reading, and possess too, a particular feeling, both of which, I suspect, are uncommon in our busy commercial newspaper reading country. Men only say they are enthusiastic about the Greek and Roman authors and history, because it is considered proper and respectable. And we know how gentlemen in Baker Street have editions of the classics handsomely bound in the library, and how they use them. Of course they don't retire to read the newspaper. It is to look over a favorite ode of Pindar, or to discuss an obscure passage in Athenaeus. Of course country magistrates and members of parliament are always studying Demosthenes and Cicero. We know it from their continual habit of quoting the Latin grammar in parliament. But it is agreed that the classics are respectable, therefore we are to be enthusiastic about them. Also let us admit that Byron is to be held up as her native bard. I am not so entire a heathen as to be insensible to the beauty of those relics of Greek art, of which men much more learned and enthusiastic have written such piles of descriptions. I thought I could recognize the towering beauty of the prodigious columns of the Temple of Jupiter, and admire the astonishing grace, severity, elegance, completeness of the Parthenon. The little Temple of Victory, with its fluted Corinthian shafts, blazed under the sun almost as fresh as it must have appeared to the eyes of its founders. I saw nothing more charming and brilliant, more graceful, festive, and aristocratic than this sumptuous little building. The Roman remains which lie in the town below look like the works of barbarians beside these perfect structures. They jar strangely on the eye, after it has been accustoming itself to perfect harmony and proportions. If, as the schoolmaster tells us, the Greek writing is as complete as the Greek art, if an ode of Pindar is as glittering and pure as the Temple of Victory, or a discourse of Plato as polished and calm as yonder mystical portico of the Erechtheum, what treasures of the senses and delights of the imagination have those lost to whom the Greek books are as good as sealed? And yet one meets with very dull first-class men. Genius won't transplant from one brain to another, or is ruined in the carriage, like fine Burgundy. Sir Robert Peel and Sir John Hobhouse are both good scholars, but their poetry in Parliament does not strike one as fine. Muzzle, the schoolmaster, who is bullying poor trembling little boys, was a fine scholar when he was a sizer, and a ruffian then and ever since. Where is the great poet, since the days of Milton, who has improved the natural offshoots of his brain by grafting it from the Athenian tree? I had a volume of Tennyson in my pocket, which somehow settled that question, and ended the querulous dispute between me and conscience, under the shape of the neglected and irritated Greek muse, which had been going on ever since I had commenced my walk about Athens. The old spinster saw me wince at the idea of the author of Dora and Ulysses, and tried to follow up her advantage by farther hints of time lost, and precious opportunities thrown away. You might have written poems like them, said she, or, no, not like them perhaps, but you might have done a neat prize poem, and pleased your papa and mama. You might have translated Jack and Jill into Greek iambics and been a credit to your college. I turn testily away from her. Adam, says I, because an eagle houses on a mountain, or soars to the sun, don't you be angry with. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.